Welcome to From the Library with Love, a podcast for anyone whose life has been changed by reading. This year marks 112 years since the Titanic hit an iceberg on the 14th of April 1912. And in that time, the doomed vessel has spawned countless myths, thousands of books, and of course James Cameron's Oscar-winning film Titanic. But in our quest to get closer to the so-called Ship of Dreams, have we overlooked the human tragedy at the heart of this disaster? In this fascinating conversation, historian and author Klaus Wetterholm from Stockholm reveals some heartbreaking, untold personal stories.
What is it about Titanic, Klaus, that interests you? What do you find so compelling about this particular disaster, really, is any way to describe it?
When I was interested, I started like any other boy or girl with fascination for the ship. But since I began going into the archives, sincerely finding all those hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of documents, and I was in Stockholm, I was in other Scandinavian cities, and then my first book, the big Titanic book, was about all the Scandinavian passengers.
Okay.
And they were way over 200 people. And then I started corresponding with people all around the world, I mean, relations to these passengers. So I got more and more and more involved with the story of the third class. And because the people from Scandinavia was almost a third of the whole third class.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes, way over 200. So that gave me a very good picture of what happened. Then I met survivors from the Titanic. I met children from survivors or children of people who had died. And then I talked the Maritime Museum in Stockholm into making a big exhibition in 1987. And we had notes all over Scandinavia about this. So answers poured in. It was just incredible to see how much material was to be found, not only in Sweden, but in other countries as well. Things that had been found on people or letters and all sorts of things. It was just incredible.
And why do you think it's captured the public's imagination? It's so compelling and enduring.
It is. I'm an ethnologist, so I have ethnological angle to it nowadays.
Okay.
And I have a fascination into the fascination. But I believe it has very, very much to do with identification, that you can actually identify with the people on the ship. That's where you begin. It could have been you and me. It could have been all the reactions and thoughts and dreams and beliefs that you find within a human being, we find there too.
Yeah.
You have anybody who's incredibly rich, so rich that they are the richest in the world. And then the ordinary immigrant, and they die in the same brutal way.
That's an interesting point, that it strips away our everyday persona. We are all just one as humanity, aren't we? So when that ship goes down, is it not true to say that they're all going to die, but ultimately those in first class and would have had a much better chance of survival?
Of course. Yeah. And statistically, then, it's a friend of mine, myself, who have gone into this thoroughly to see. And then we find out that statistically, people from third class are only to be found in the last four large lifeboats, plus two collapsibles that were launched in the end. But apart from that, you don't find any third class. And it's very simple. They did not find their way up. And to start with, nobody told them how to get up on deck. So there they were. They were left.
Yeah.
One steward, Hart was his name. I've met his son, actually. He was a third class steward. And he took groups of third class passengers and guided them up on deck. And when he came up on deck, the first group, he left them there, turned back, brought the second group up. Then he was ordered into lifeboat, I think it was 15, by First Officer Murdoch. And when that boat was lowered and rowed away, Hart knew that there were hundreds and hundreds of people still left.
Right.
Who hadn't even come up on deck. He knew that. And he had to live with this knowledge for the rest of his life.
Yeah. Those people had been failed ultimately, hadn't they?
Mm-hmm.
Because of their class.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think? I'm really interested to know about these 200 new exhibits that are being are going to be shown in this exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk me through some of the stories behind your favourite ones? One or any of it that you feel are most revealing or offer something new or as a new perspective?
Every single object has a story in the exhibition. So, for example, you have... we have a diary from a Finnish passenger, third-class passenger. This diary was found on his body, and he kept this diary on board the Titanic. And that diary is absolutely unique because he writes in Swedish. He was Swedish Finn, and he writes what happens every day. And then he writes a little about the 14th of April, the same day that the ship collided with the iceberg. And mentions that there are people from all around the globe here. And today it's raining, he says. It's very astonishing. So they have to stay, the women must stay under deck, he says. We have the ring that was found in boat A, which is a collapsible boat. And this collapsible boat was the last to leave the Titanic, but it was never launched. It just floated off. And there were two third-class passengers from South Sweden, a married couple, and Edvard and Gerda Lindell, and Edvard managed to climb into the boat. But since it was a collapsible and should have canvas sides, they had no time to lift the sides. So it was just a wooden keel that was floating away. So they were standing up or just sitting in the water, which is minus half a degree. Another Swedish passenger tried to hold his wife because she was clinging to the reeling. And he said afterwards that I couldn't pull her up because that would have risked the lifeboat. It would have capsized again. So he dropped her and she disappeared immediately. My own theory, that the family has a theory, but my theory is it because it was so incredibly cold. Her fingers were so frozen that her wedding ring fell off her finger and dropped into the boat.
Right.
The man who tried to hold her, he says in an interview afterwards that the bodies floated so tight together that you thought you could walk over them. Oof. And from our strange little craft, one after the other fell down and died. They were saved by another lifeboat. 12 people survived, all in all. But boat A was never looked after. It disappeared in the darkness and drifted away in the North Atlantic. And 1 month later, this lifeboat was sighted by White Star Lines Oceanic, and they recovered the boat. And when they surveyed the boat, they found a ring at the bottom of the boat. And it was a mystery. So the ring was taken to the White Star Line in New York. They investigated the ring and they saw there is an inscription here in the ring. And they thought it could have been a Swedish ring. So they sent it together with a letter to the Swedish consulate in New York. And there they didn't know neither what to do with the ring. So they returned it to Stockholm to the Swedish Foreign Ministry. And they were also puzzled. So they had notes advertising this ring and asked for relatives. And this woman, Gerda's brother, worked as a conductor for Swedish railroads between Malmö in the south and Gothenburg in the west. And one day in Gothenburg, when he had bought a local regional paper, he saw this ad about Gerda Lindell's ring. And he must have said to himself, oh my God, they found her ring. Took the paper to his parents, who were completely broken down by grief, And in the summer of 1912, the ring was returned to the parents, and then it was gone. I was reading the stories in the public archives in Stockholm, and the receipts are there, and this letter from White Star Line is there. Everything is there, but no ring. This is the mid-80s. I said to myself throughout the years that I don't think this ring has been thrown away. Somewhere in Sweden, I was sure that there must be a ring. This ring must exist. So then we had, back in 1991, at the Maritime Museum, the artifacts raised from the Titanic, and it was an enormous success, the greatest they'd ever had. So it was decided to tour the exhibition, and the first place was Malmö in the south. And the curator had to work very hard, because you're always late when you mount an exhibition. But he took off one day and went to this nearby town, for his daughter went to a birthday party for children. But he was too tired to walk around, and he was just sitting there when a friend passed and looked at him and said to him, "You look absolutely devastated. What's going on?" "Yeah," he said, we're building a new exhibition now. We work day and night." "Aha," she said, "what sort of exhibition is it this time?" "Well, now it's the Titanic," he said. And then she said, "Then I'm going to tell you something. I have had relatives on the Titanic." So the next day he called me, and he was, as we say in Swedish, fire and flame, and talked and talked and talked until I said, "Well, calm down now. I've never heard stories like this." Then he said something about the ring. "Don't you know anything about this?" he said. And then things became a bit odd. But when we were to open the exhibition, I forgot the telephone call, because there was too much to do. And one of our most famous troubadours was to open it, because he'd written a song about the Titanic. So we opened the exhibition, and a couple of days when I had one of my guided tours, a lady came up to me, and this following happened. "Hello," she said, "I'm Gunilla Jenrup." "Hello," I said, "where is the ring?" I could have said, "How do you do?" but I forgot. And then she said, "The ring, there's nothing special about that ring. My mother has it on her finger since years." And then it turns out that her dear little mother had become a little bulkier through the years. And then she had asked her husband then if it was okay that she put her wedding ring in the bank safe, and instead she could use Aunt Gerda's ring. So a couple of days later, I was sitting in this tiny flat in Malmö, holding the golden ring from the Titanic.
So it came back, it came full circle, it came back to you.
And then I asked the family, "Can we please show the ring?" So millions of people have seen the ring. Wow. And have heard the story.
And what was her name, the lady who owned the ring?
Gerda Lindel. I can send the name. It's Gerda, it's spelled G-E-R-D-A, Gerda or Gerda.
G-E-R-D-A, Gerda, okay.
Lindel, yeah. When I talk with Louise about the exhibition, I keep saying that it is the human story. Mm-hmm. And then there is one more thing that I keep telling when I do guided tours, and it's a quote from Milan Kundera, the Czechish author. He writes in one of his novels that as long as you mention somebody's name, this person is alive. This person lives with us. So by telling the story of Gerda and Ingvard, although they disappeared in the North Atlantic, they're still with us.
I absolutely understand that.
And this is, you see, one of the reasons for the family letting us having the ring on display, because we tell their story.
I couldn't agree more. And it's funny you say that. I have just finished editing a book that I've written, and in one of the opening quotes in the book is, "A person dies twice, once when they stop breathing, and a second time when their name is spoken for the last time." Yeah. And I think that's so true of history, isn't it? That when we stop speaking people's names, then they are really gone. Whereas this is a wonderful way of resurrecting people that might have been forgotten. You know, we know the wealthy, we know the titled, we know the people in first class, but we don't know the names of the people in third class, because we just don't, do we? And it's through those little ordinary stories that very human lives come back to life, like this lady whose ring was rediscovered. Mm. Why is that important to you?
telling the stories about the people. Well, it's because I've been fascinated by the Titanic, but very much because I've gotten so much into the people, the stories.
Yeah.
And when I meet, for example, met Gerda's niece and her daughter, this is what is fascinating to me. When I meet people, when I met the nephew of the first officer, William Murdoch, Scott Murdoch, when I met the lady whose mother survived, and she lent us the mother's shoes and the blanket they swept around the then child in the lifeboat, the shoes she had on the Titanic that we are displaying.
Okay.
I traveled to San Francisco to pick up the shoes, send them. No.
Press them to go in the boat. And what was this lady's name?
Louise King. She was 4 years old, and she survived, remarkably enough, with her father and her mother, because her mother and herself had been placed in this boat, and it was one of the last boats. And the seamen had then created a human chain around the boat, so that no one should be able to storm the boat. They came from Zurich, they spoke German. And as the boat was being lowered, these two women started screaming hysterically in German to the husband, father, standing behind the sailors. And they screamed he should save himself, and they screamed in German. And the sailors didn't understand German. So he saw his chance, and he dove under the arms of the sailors and threw himself into the boat and survived.
And this was the very last boat, was it?
Yeah, and then this girl, Louise King, that I have met actually several times, she kept the shoes and the blanket, the shoes she was carrying on the Titanic. She kept it together with the blanket in a box all her life. And her daughter Jonas told me that she never spoke about this, but they found it when Louise was gone.
Really?
Yeah. And then I asked the daughter Joan, can we have it, please, showing it in the exhibition? And she said yes.
Okay.
And she thinks it's a great idea. So that's another.
Yeah.
I mean, if you took a pair of old children's shoes to try and sell, they would be worth nothing.
Cool. Yeah. As a piece,
and
of-
we had this watch. We have a watch from a Swedish third class passenger. He died, and this watch was found, and his artifact was kept by his daughter. And when the daughter was died, they found his things in a shoebox. And now we have this watch in the exhibition, and the person who just called, my friend here, partner, he's an antique dealer, and he took it to an antique hall where they have specialists in watches, and he asked for valuation of the watch, and the man said, the expert said, well, it's worth 50p, but it's been on the Titanic,
and then suddenly
it's £40,000.
Yeah. of course.
Yeah. But the watch is there with the hand still there. Everything is there with the watch.
Okay.
And he had it on his body. Yeah. And it was found on his body.
Yeah.
Now you have three examples of things that we show. But I think that what we show are very personal objects. Things that have been found in pockets. Letters that have been written, for example. And then, of course, other things, advertising, whatever you can think, china, silver, what there is. Mm. But I think that it's really the personal objects that catch you.
Yeah. I agree. Absolutely.
I've seen people standing by the showcases with tears in their eyes, listening to the story. Mm. I've seen it many times.
It gives us a connection, doesn't it, to that?
Very much. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things I think as well, Klaus, that sets my understanding of what sets this exhibition apart from others that is new and perhaps not done before is the recreated rooms. Is that right? That they're aiming to do? Tell me about that. And were you involved with that?
Not so much, because that's what they had when I came in 2003. So we have a third class cabin and a first class suite. We are going to expand. It's all a question of size and how much is there room for, actually. Yeah. I wanted a second class cabin, for example, because we have the only surviving wash cabinet in the world, which is from the sister ship. They were identical on the Titanic,
okay,
Olympic. It's the only one left. And I'd like to build a second class cabin around it.
Yeah, that would be interesting, because then you get the full spectrum, don't you?
Oh, yes.
So talk me through the difference between the first class cabin and the third class. I mean, I can imagine it, but I'd like to hear your words.
An ordinary ticket to the United States from Gothenburg via Hull, Southampton, New York was 181 kroner, which is a little less than £8. £8, a little less. An ordinary working class family in Sweden paid the year after 1913, I found in the archive, for their flat for a whole year, 179 kroner, which means that a ticket to the United States was the same as the flat for a year, the flat fee for a whole year. With that money, you can buy one single ticket in third class.
Wow.
Now, that is £8. We have a suite that was rented by a woman from Canada called Helen Baxter. She paid £247.
So that tells you the difference, £8 to £247.
Yes. Yeah. Wow. So an ordinary flat today is roughly... I don't know what prices, I guess, are higher in England, but here you would have to pay, let's say you pay 10,000, 15,000 pounds a year, something like
that. What, to rent? Do you mean for rental?
Yes.
Or purchase?
Yeah.
Oh, I think beyond that. I mean, prices of renting a flat in London, I'm sure Natalia will tell you, are just astronomical at the moment.
Let's say it's 100,000 Swedish kroner or 8,000 pounds would be the same as £8.
Yeah.
So and that's what you have to see. You have to see, what did people pay for a loaf of bread?
Yeah.
Or egg? How much did they make? How much did they have to work? How many hours to buy a loaf of bread?
Absolutely.
That's how I compare prices then and now.
Yeah.
And if you pay £247, you have so much money that you don't have to think how you spend the money.
Of course. It's a it doesn't have the same value or worth to you.
You could, as we say in Swedish, sneezes out of your nose.
yeah, of course. It meant nothing to them, did it? But so that I can imagine the opulence and the comfort compared to those below the decks must have been significant. Well,
there was nothing wrong with her thoughts. The best advertising the West Airline could have were pleased passengers. So they made sure that there was good food. And the lodging was fine and okay. And when I read stories and also spoke to survivors, they said there was nothing wrong with our cabins. And this old lady survived with her, she was then just a child, with her sister and her mother. And her mother used to say that we're very well off in third class and the food was excellent. And the ship was new, everything was freshly painted, everything was just in good order.
They weren't
order.
Slumming it then, essentially.
No.
But comparatively speaking, it was still quite clean and they were happy with their surroundings.
I'll give you a very funny little detail here. The largest language, of course, was English among the passengers, because the largest passenger group was British. The second largest was American. And the third largest, depending how you count, were Swedish or Irish. So this means that the second largest language on the Titanic after English was Swedish.
Okay, I did not know that. That's interesting.
The fifth largest passenger group on the Titanic were Arabs.
Really?
So the third largest language among the passengers was Arabic.
And where had the Arabs come? Where were they? Yeah. Where had they been living? Where had they boarded the boat?
they came from the present Syria and Lebanon. They'd come by boat over the Mediterranean and train from Marseille to Cherbourg, where they boarded the Titanic. And there were about 100 of those.
Okay. So it was a very multicultural boat then, as you'd expect, because people were migrating to America to start new lives, presumably. So it was going to be a melting pot of culture.
Funny enough, there were very few Spanish people and Germans, very few.
Really?
There were many more Finns and Norwegians.
Right. But isn't it interesting that in popular culture, we tend to view Titanic through the, and because of course it's been dominated that way, but we tend to view it through the eyes of English and American. It's almost as if people sort of whitewashed out that there were Arabs and Swedish and German and other, we tend not to see it. I think if you just viewed Titanic through the films and the popular culture, you wouldn't know what a melting pot of immigration there was there.
I'm publishing a book in April called The Swedes on the Titanic.
Okay.
And I've already heard people say you should translate it. Among them, Eric in London, who did the translation of another book I've written now about the Second World War. So we'll see what happens. This morning I continued working with putting the pictures into the book where I want them. And then we'll see what the designer editor say tomorrow.
Okay. Oh, well, I keep my fingers crossed for you.
Yeah. Many pictures and so many, like interiors and you name it, that are not known.
Yeah.
So I'm going to, there was a company selling all sorts of utilities for bathrooms and such. I'm adding a toilet roll holder because this is just a funny little detail that I came across not so long ago. That they had automatic flushing in third class.
Really?
Of course, people from many countries had never seen a toilet stool before in their whole life. They didn't know how to use it.
Really? So where had they?
Yeah.
Where
had they, so well, if they came from whatever, Bulgaria, Romania, Russia, wherever.
And
they
were
used for privacy, you know. And nothing else.
Yeah.
So there were these women were stewardesses in third class who used to do teaching third class passengers how to use the toilet.
That's a lovely detail. I like that.
Yeah, it is. It's just a detail that I came across and I thought was quite fun.
Yeah.
Things like that you don't think.
Actually, this ship was the sort of, you know, a luxury of its time, you know, and very advanced for its time, even on third class. We tend to view third class as something slumming it and a bit sort of very basic and rudimentary, and we're in fact,
they had only two bathtubs for 1,000 people.
Is that right? Whereas I'm imagining your suite, you'd have your own ensuite bathtub, would you?
Yes and no, because this is the reason for why these older passenger liners from before the First World War were outdated in the 1920s, because when they were built, very, very few cabins had a bathroom. Even in first class, you had to go out in the corridor and go to a public toilet, bathroom, shower.
Yeah.
So when they took photos of the sister ship in Belfast, they also made sure to show the sinks. If there was a sink in first class, it was important to show.
Yeah.
But there were extremely few bathrooms for first class.
Right. Well, I suppose nowadays we assume it's an assumption, isn't it? But actually, people didn't have that assumption that hot and cold running water and sanitation would be, it wasn't as a pervasive as it is now, is it? It wasn't an expected.
Yeah, well, you have to place yourself back in 1912 and not use our eyes.
Yes.
That is the difficult thing.
Yeah.
You have to think like that.
With these recreated rooms, is that going to enable us to place ourselves? Because it's one thing to tell somebody something, but it's quite another to show them, isn't it? So here, look, this is the room, what they would have had.
Yeah, you could, but it's easier to talk about the lifeboats and how the constructors and the ship owners thought then, because they thought that a ship like this was so big that nothing could happen.
Yeah, of course, of course.
And everything should have been changed years and years and years, but it is the same with us today. You need a big disaster and accident to understand that this is no good.
Well, just look at Grenfell Tower. It's not until
you begin to realize, okay,
it takes a disaster to bring about change and reform.
Yes, yeah. And the same thing with the Titanic. And we can say that they were stupid then, but we are as stupid today. We create power bombs. And
how much have we really learned?
Yes, what have we learned? What have we learned?
It's a very good question. That actually, to give it a modern parallel is very interesting, isn't it? Because it's very easy to look back and go, "Oh, goodness me, they only had that many lifeboats for that many people."
Yeah. Well,
you know, things happen today with large-scale loss of life, and we haven't really learned the lessons, have we?
Yeah. When I take groups and tour, the last room has all the names of those who perished, and then I ask the question: did they die in vain? And I said, no, they did not, because their deaths resulted in what we call SOLAS today, Safety of Life at Sea, which is an international agreement for every ship in the world that goes to sea must have enough lifeboats, life-saving equipment. So something changed completely.
Because of that.
Yeah, although we have this wound in Sweden with the Estonia ferry disaster, and it never ends. It is debated day after day after day for 27 years.
Yeah.
I found a box I had bought in Belfast years ago called Titanic Tea, which is the same.
What is so Titanic Tea?
It's a package with a picture of the Titanic containing tea bags.
which leads me to an interesting question, actually. Do you feel that we have somehow sort of almost, we've made such a tourist attraction of essentially what is quite a profound loss of life, you know, Titanic tea. You wouldn't get the same thing, for example, I know it happened a long time ago, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it diminishes have we almost Disneyfied this? Like, I mean, you wouldn't dream of having World War One trenches tea or, you know, Blitz tea. Why have we made the Titanic this great big sort of, slightly almost sort of, we've sugarcoated it to some degree. And we've made it a tourist attraction.
I know. It's an extremely fascinating question. There are books about it. How come the Titanic does not affect us in that way any longer? It's not dangerous. You can read about it. It's a completely different story with what you read, atrocities, the Holocaust and such.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't get Auschwitz tea, for goodness sake. Mm-hmm. Why is it okay? I mean, I have a sort of problem with that, really.
You can have, I don't know how many jokes I have about the Titanic. So many.
People died in horrendous ways. I mean... Yeah.
It's ridiculous. That's just one. But I think it has to do also, if you place it in time, there was still a time in 1912 when myths were told, stories were told. Myths are told today, but you see them in a much different way today than back then. If I go back to the Estonia ferry disaster, I have seen very few jokes about this ship because you can't joke about it here. It's too traumatized. The other day, only a week ago, I saw the first printed joke about the Estonia in a newspaper. Nobody dare joke about it. No one.
Yeah. So why is it okay with Titanic then?
Yeah, why is it? That's a very interesting question. Why? Because it doesn't scare us. It's not dangerous in such a way. Too many things seem to have happened in between us and the Titanic. Yeah. And she has become...
Softened it, you mean?
Yeah. In ethnology, you speak about a vessel, which is, it could be an idea. Something has happened that you can use for your own purposes. And the Titanic is the perfect vessel. You can use the Titanic for anything there is. Anything.
So In other words, it's become a symbol of something.
Very much so. Very
much. What does it become a symbol of? Do you think it's this? Do you think people are fascinated because so many people were going in search of new lives? They were pioneers.
Anybody going to sea is a humanity. I mean, everybody on a ship becomes a humanity.
Mm.
You depend on each other, want it or not, but you depend on each other on a ship. If something happens, You must think of that. And the Titanic is the perfect disaster. Usually you say that a myth is man's connection with God or gods, and we don't have any myths from the 20th century except the Titanic. Titanic is a myth creator. And here you come in again on identification. You can identify.
Right.
But you can do whatever you want with the Titanic. Load her with.
It's become a chameleon. It's become.
Oh, yeah.
We all impress upon the Titanic something that's some yearning within ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. So I had one of my lectures is actually about myth and money, because that's the next thing, Titanic and money. I usually say that the Second World War and the Titanic has been very, very financially very successful.
For whom?
For those who used the Second World War and the Titanic. For James Cameron, for anybody who makes use the Titanic. For me, I mean, I've had the Titanic as a profession, full-time profession, since 1996.
Right.
That's and half-time profession since 1986. So I had it as a profession for 35 years, and I live out of it. I mean, I paid my summer house is paid by the Titanic, and my flat here, and my car, and you name it.
So that's a really interesting.
It was a hobby when I was. Yeah, it was just a hobby, and then suddenly things began to happen.
So it's become an industry, an economy, a whole.
Oh yes. And if you take the books, this is interesting because. I haven't bought books for about a year now because my flat is full. I have nowhere to put stuff any longer. But there are books published. If you, it's not possible to find the exact number, but let's say that from 1st of September 1985, when the wreck was found, until today, it is at least one book every week between 2011. In 2012, I know this because I bought them all, there were way over 300 books. So then you had a new book every second day for 2 years. That's well done.
Yeah. I mean, this is a whole juggernaut of an industry around. How many books do you think have been published on Titanic? Just as an estimate, what do you think?
Well, I have here about 3,000 books. I think that there are many, many more than that.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I'm trying to digitalize my library, and it takes ages. And I've done the oversized one, not the rare books, none, but the ordinary bookshelves, about 2,400, 500 books.
That's astonishing when you think essentially what happened, a ship set sail, it hit an iceberg.
And it sank,
and lots of people drowned. And lots of people die, but lots and lots of people have died in other ways in disasters that could have been preventable in the 20th century, and yet they don't seem to fuel this whole industry. But I'm interested in what you're saying, going back to about mythology and all of us impressing upon. There is something about the notion of Titanic that seems to speak to some need in all of us, whether we settle down with a book or whether we clicked to view an exhibition, whether we think, yes, I'd love to go to London and walk amongst the Titanic rooms and imagine myself on that ship. It is speaking to some inherent need with all of us.
It's also control, because it's like reading a thriller story or doing a puzzle. You want to be in control.
Yeah.
Studying the Titanic, but in particular, is being in control. You're in control of the story.
Yeah.
And you do whatever you want with this story.
Yeah.
I've seen so much of this, and also the fascination I see with children come to the exhibition. six, seven, eight, nine, 10 years old, and they stand there with open eyes and, as we say in Swedish, elephant ears. More and more and more.
And why? What do you think children get out of it? What is it about them? Is it the size of the ship, the kind of the mythology, the fable, the drama?
I think to start with, it's the story in itself. A very large ship, the largest ever created, the finest ever done. It should have been the safest. And when you hear these ingredients and know that it sank and took so many people with it down. I remember myself being fascinated by the story. I couldn't really explain then, but it was something with it may never happen again. And it was a shock to humanity and so on and so on. It was very much so. But you should ask children yourself.
Yeah, I think I will. My son is 10 and he's quite interested. I'll ask him what it is in his words, perhaps, that he sees.
Yeah, do.
Yeah, maybe I will.
You can go to any part of the world and ask a child to say a ship and they say Titanic.
Yeah.
Did you read about this autistic boy in Iceland? He didn't speak, he didn't talk, didn't do anything. And he built the then largest Titanic model in the world out of Lego.
No, really?
And suddenly, he began to talk. He began to communicate.
Interesting that something about Titanic recreated this boy's facade.
So he started to communicating through the story. Yeah, it's fascinating.
That's incredible.
So you can find him on the internet. I think it's... autistic boy or Lego model.
Maybe if there is a positive upside to that, such a large scale loss of life, it's that there is something about this story that speaks to people, that can break down boundaries. And I'll give you another example. I interviewed a lady the other day who is a librarian, and she worked for 26 years in a very impoverished borough of Stepney in East London. And she worked at Stepney and Whitechapel Library in the 1950s. And 60s, and there was huge poverty then. She said they had no money whatsoever, and a lot of the children in the summer months would be just dumped at the library. Their parents would go out to work and they would use the library as a sort of almost like a children's creche. So every summer she had hordes of children and no idea what to do with them. So she said to me, one year we came up, as in her and the children, came up with the idea to make the Titanic out of matchsticks. And so they did. And she said it took hold of everybody's imaginations. And she said all through that summer, what happened in the end is word spread and people from the local factories would bring, the East End is heartland of the schmutter, the sort of dressmaking rag trade. And they would bring cotton reels and cotton bobbles and people would begin to leave things on the library steps. And so they used all this manner of leftover material to create the Titanic. And she said it took us 6 weeks. And when we had finished, we sat under the stern and we read Moby Dick and we read stories and Treasure Island. She said it really helped the children's imagination come to life. So I suppose there is that other side to it, that it does enable our imaginations to spark into life and create a story for people. So, I think that there are some very fascinating side effects.
Well, it's an incredibly fascinating story you're telling.
Yeah,
you should go and ask more children, what is it with the Titanic? I have my story, and everybody who's interested have their own story. Everybody has a story. Mm. Every visitor to the exhibition has a story.
Yes, they're all coming through the doors with something in their head as to what they want to find out about and what they want to learn and what's their own personal connection to the disaster. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's so interesting, and I think the exhibition will do fantastically well, I'm sure, because again, we're all seeking experiences now, as we've been deprived of it. So the experience of walking through a recreated rooms will be compelling to a lot of people. What myths do you most want to shatter with this exhibition? What do you want people to learn that they didn't know before?
Well, I don't mention it in the audio tour, but I think a myth which most people still believe in is the story of women and children first. Because the difference between saved women and saved men Can more women than men survive the Titanic?
Okay.
If you count the children, boys like as men and girls as women, the difference is 6 people.
Oh, okay. So it's only 6 women more than men.
And then of course, there are those who say to me, you can't say like that because there were so many more men on the ship and so on. So I say, that is not the point. The point is that there was a story created in 1912 to save the honor of the British seamanship. And then the story goes that it was a well-organized saving operation, and preferably those who survived were women and children. And it's not true.
Really?
Just look at the figures.
And so what is the truth?
The truth is that most of the men who survived were on the starboard side. And they survived because First Officer Murdoch didn't stop them, didn't prevent them from going into the boat. On the other side, on the port side, preferably Second Officer Lightoller had a rule, women and children, and he took it literally, women and children only. So boats were sent away that could take 65 people. And there were men standing there. They wanted to go into the lifeboats and were not allowed because they had rules. So the boats were sent away. One could take 65 and rowed away with 28. They had rules.
Okay.
It was more important with rules than saving lives.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes.
And who was running those lifeboats? Mostly English crew, was it?
Yeah. So on the other side, when Murdoch was in charge, if men were there, he said, of course, you can step in.
Right.
And I have several Swedish survivors, men, who said that I jumped into the water and swam to a lifeboat, but most of them were lying. They could not say in 1912 that I stepped into a lifeboat. There's so much to this. If you go into the inquiries and the reports and you see how people were treated and so on, it's fascinating. You can't stop reading the inquiry. And there was a third-class steward whose name was Rule, and he was called to the inquiry, and he said that in my boat, number 13, the majority were men. So there were about 40 men and 20 women and children.
Right.
And the inquiry couldn't believe this. He was called back, and they told him, you can read it, they told him that you're wrong, aren't you?
Really?
And then he said, well, no, he said. And then there was a big problem for the inquiry. How do we do? What do we do with this story? Because it's impossible that the second last lifeboat on the starboard side, that should have been packed with women and children. Most of them were men.
Right. So it doesn't fit the narrative that they wanted to.
Then when he left, he was just about to leave. The one of the assessors turned to him. He was representing the stewards. And said that, have you had bad sleeping since the disaster? And he said, yes. I mean, if you've seen 1,500 people die, of course you might have trouble with your sleeping. And he said, have you been to a doctor? Yes, he said. And your memory might have been affected because of this. Yes, that's possible, he said. And then he left. And there they were. They saved it. They saved the story.
Right.
But then a friend of mine and myself have put together all the stories of those people who stepped into the boats. And then we realized that he was right. The steward was right.
Right. So there were boats traveling away with majority men on.
Mm-hmm, the last on the starboard side, both 13 and 15,
right.
The majority were men.
Right. That's so interesting, isn't it?
And that's where you find the cross.
Yeah. And yet, were you to ask anybody, they'd say, oh, women and children first, always, you wouldn't find that. Yeah. So that's a very interesting little story to me that...
But that there are, of course, more stories to it, yes.
Yeah.
You have conspiracy theories that the Titanic never sank and such.
You always get conspiracy theories, though, don't you?
Yes.
So that's one myth that you wanted to expose, that it was all women and children, quite clearly it wasn't. Are there any others that you wish to
illuminate? Well, it is the story about the unsinkability that... Today we say the Titanic sank and she was unsinkable. And then I say that all those ships that never sank, they must be sinkable. But it's because they called it practically unthinkable. And this practically disappeared in the advertising and became unthinkable. But every ship that was constructed in the same way as the Titanic, with bulkheads and watertight doors and such, they were labeled unthinkable. Now, can you see, if I hold it like this, this book here, can you see it?
Unsinkable ships, yeah.
Hmm?
Unsinkable. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's about selling watertight doors. If I open it now, you know, you've seen the title. If I open it and do like this.
Stone Limited, Deptford, London, ships practically unsinkable.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's almost like the disclaimer on the inside.
Yeah.
So essentially, what you're saying is that the boat was sort of almost victim of a good marketing job. It was marketing.
Very much so. Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Because any ship was practically unsinkable. Even our old rowing boat, the Summer House, was practically unsinkable. I've a horrible experience of that.
On a slightly smaller scale to the Titanic.
Yeah. But you see, when you said that there's a difference between unthinkable and cannot sink.
Yes, yeah.
No one seems to think about this, but this catalogue I showed you was printed in 1906, which is 6 years before the Titanic. And then these words were used throughout and nobody thought of it, but you needed a big ship like the Titanic to disprove this.
Right, of course. It's so interesting, isn't it, that when we look back with the benefit of time and a modern perspective, what a different complexion that puts on things. But I think for me, the most interesting thing of this article, and I very much hope to see this exhibition, but is about what it is, the mythology of it, and how what it does for each one of us, and why this enduring, compelling fascination with something that we have almost ceased to see it for what it is, that it is a very large loss of life, you know, with this whole furore of industry, you know, and the teas and the sort of the souvenir culture and exhibitions, that we have disassociated ourselves with it. And yet it still speaks to us in such a way. I find it's so fascinating, isn't it? And hopefully you've enabled me to get under the skin of that a bit, which is fascinating. So thank you very much for that, Klaus.
I really hope that you enjoyed that conversation. If you have any questions or comments about any of the topics raised in our conversation, or perhaps you have a story you'd like to share, then do get in touch via my website, Facebook or Instagram, details of which are all listed on the podcast. Thanks for listening.